Delight to be here with you tonight, and we want to continue thinking about what happens when God builds a family. And last week we talked about the definition of marriage. Marriage is a leaving, cleaving, committed, or one flesh kind of relationship. Tonight I want to talk to you about marriage as completion. And to drive at that, I want to look at a couple of passages with you. The first is in there was another slide. That's an old slide. I want to look at this passage, Genesis chapter 1, verse 26 through 27. Now God said, "Let us make man in our own image, according to our likeness. Let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, over the birds of the air, over the cattle, over all the earth, and every living creeping thing that creeps on the earth." So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created him. Now, just hold that up for a minute. Notice that it's not men who are created in the image of God. God says, "I'm going to create them in my image," and so he creates male and female. So male and female are both created in God's image. Now, a lot of scholars would say, a lot of biblical scholars would say, and I believe that they're right, that male and female, the unique qualities that we have come together. God has all those qualities. God has male qualities in perfection, and he has female qualities in perfection. But for you and I, we're given usually a part of those. So for instance, God is a protector. He's a warrior. He's a lion, but he's also a nurturer. So the Bible will say he's a lion, but he's also a mother hen. He says, I want to gather you under my wings like a hen would gather her chicks. God is strong. He can be, I don't want to say dogmatic, but he can be fierce, but he can also be incredibly tender with us. He embodies all of the best qualities of what we would consider maleness and femaleness. Now, so we are all created in God's image. All of the qualities of God, which he has in perfection, are displayed in not only maleness, but femaleness. Now, you look at Ephesians chapter 5, and we see that although they're both created in God's image, you'll see a differentiation because, again, they're both in his image, but they're different expressions of his image. It says, now, they're all submitting to one another in the fear of God. Wives, submit to your husbands as to the Lord. Now you just notice that he says, submit to each other, but wives, you get it twice, men get it once. So maybe wives don't hear it like men hear it. Okay, wives, submit to your own husbands as to the Lord. For the husband is the head of the wife, and also Christ is the head of the church, and he's the Savior of the body. Therefore, just as the church is subject to Christ, so let wives be to their own husbands in everything. Husbands, love your wives, just as Christ also loved the church and gave himself for her. And then at the end he says, this is a great mystery, but I speak concerning Christ and the church. Nevertheless, let each of you in particular so love his own wife as himself, and let the wife see that she respects her husband. So again, both are created in the image of God, but then that's one passage. There's a differentiation of how that plays out. Now, again, the submission things sort of gets talked about a lot because it says, wives, submit to your husbands. But then it also says, husbands, love your wives. Then it says there at the end, husbands, love your wives, and wives, see that you respect your husband. So you're both in the image of God, but you're fulfilling different roles. But notice those aren't exclusive roles, because you can't say, well, only wives are supposed to submit to their husbands, because then you'd have to say, well, only husbands are supposed to love their wives. Wives don't have to love their husbands. Then you'd have to say, well, husbands to love their wives, but they don't have to respect their wives, and wives are supposed to respect their husbands, but again, they don't have to love. No, everybody has to do everything. A wife has to love and respect and submit to her husband, and a husband has to, at some level, submit and love and respect his wife. But again, others, different components are given the lead in those areas, because again, you can't say, well, a wife submit, and but they don't have to love. Everybody has to love. You can't go to heaven if you don't love. Everybody's got to love. So if the wives and the husbands have to love at some level, surely they both have to submit at some level. Surely they both have to respect at some level. So the point is that, number one, there are differences in men and women. And that plays out in Scripture. Now, I just say that, and I think that many of you would say, well, that's the dumbest thing to say. Why spend a lot of time there? But you live in this culture. And you realize that one of the hotly debated issues of our day is whether men and women are born men and women, or whether they're socially conditioned to be men and women. And hence we have a great amount of people saying, I was born in the wrong body and I want to transition, or I'm a female, but I feel like my true nature is male. That plays out in a lot of thinking. There are those who would say that maleness and femaleness are, again, socially conditioned. They would say boys and girls in general are treated very differently when they're little, and that accounts for why they turn out different. So, for instance, boys are roughhoused in ways that little girls are not. They're dressed differently. They would say that men talk to their sons in more of a command tone as opposed to their daughters. They would say that mothers make stronger eye contact with their daughters and their sons, and that has an effect. They would say that mothers tend to be sterner with their daughters. They tend to excuse things with their boys, and that creates a desire for the daughters to be more people-pleasing. There would be dozens of these things that they would say are socially conditioned, so that male and female are not necessarily innate, but they're socially conditioned. I find it strange in our culture, by the way, that the people who are very adamant that male and female is a social conditioning would say homosexuality is not a social condition. That seems to me to be strange, that you say, well, you know, you don't know what it is until it decides for itself. So male or female, it could go either way, but you're born homosexual. That's innate, male and female or not. That seems to be a strange contradiction to me. It's like one of my pet peeves. I find it very strange for people to say you can't backslide on earth, but the devil backslid out of heaven. It's very strange that you can backslide in heaven but not on earth. This seems to be a strange combination to me. And again, it's a strange combination to say gender isn't innate, but homosexuality would be innate. That's a crazy combination to me. But anyway, maybe you don't see it that way. So there are, again, the Bible would say that there are innate differences in men and women. And that's why in the Bible, for instance, when Adam and Eve sin, they're given different punishments. When Adam sins, God comes to him in Genesis 3 and essentially says, you're going to work in the dirt to get food. You're going to be a farmer. And then he essentially says, and that's going to be frustrated. So here is Adam, and the thing that he would get a lot of fulfillment from, because men tend to get fulfillment from their work, he says, you're not going to get it, and essentially you're going to try to rule over the ground, but the ground is going to rule over you, in a sense. But to the wife, he says, there's going to be there's going to be pain in childbirth. And he said, your desire is going to be for your husband, but he shall rule over you. So the husband, the thing that he perhaps would naturally enjoy most is work. God says, it's going to be frustrated. It's not going to go well. You're going to have constant struggles with your work, and ultimately the ground is sort of going to rule over it. You're going to have to serve the ground to get your food. And then to the wife, he says, you know, the thing that might be most fulfilling to you is childbirth, having a baby, but I'm going to make that one of the most painful things in your life. And you really want to be close to your husband. Your desire is for him, but I'm going to make sure that there's a frustration there that you can never gain the equality you want. There's something inside of him that perhaps wants to rule over you. So there's frustration in as a result of their sin, but it's a different thing. And in that way, God is saying, you two are different. I see Adam different than I see Eve. The punishments are different because Adam is different than Eve. And I think that again, plays out I see that, and I think most of you would see that as just common sense. Men and women are different. You see that in size. Men tend to be larger physically, and they particularly tend to have a lot of more upper body strength in the shoulders and arms. That's why 99% of brick masons are men. God love the feminists, but they're not trying to go 50-50 on the brick masonry. Not trying to get equal standing there. There's a lot of jobs, let's face it, that men, because of upper body strength, just seem to naturally do better with. Now, that's not to say that every man is bigger than every woman, but the largest man tends to be bigger than the largest woman, and the smallest man tends to be bigger than the smallest woman. Now, even having said that, actually in domestic disputes, I hear that women actually try to hit men more than the men try to hit women. And I don't understand that, because we're delightful to live with. I don't know why women would take more shots at a man than a man would take at a woman. But men get prosecuted for it far more than women, because why? Well, when a woman hits a man, it doesn't do the damage that it does when a man hits a woman. There's a size difference. There's a strength difference. The struggles are different. Men tend to struggle with alcoholism, drug addiction, learning disorders, and attention deficit disorders, for instance, far more than women do. In fact, when I was reading that, I said, you know, that's right. All the little kids running around with ADD, attention deficit disorder, it's like 9 out of 10 are boys. I understand that, but that's a wiring that boys have. Alcohol issues, drug issues, learning deficit disorders, attention deficit tend to be, you know, things that men struggle with by a wide margin. Women struggle far more with depression and anxiety. And there are people who say that's because they're wired to be mothers. If you think about it, babies, you have to be hyper alert with babies. I mean, up until about a year, anything can kill a kid. I mean, you got to be hyper alert to take care of a baby. You just got to be on it. And that plays out as a child grows. I mean, even in my family, I can't remember the last time I told Jenny, now that's not safe. If anybody says, stop it, that's not safe, it's her telling me that's not safe to do with the kids. You can't do that. You can't throw them. You can't leave them. That's not safe. She's far more wired to be safe, even as the kids get older. You know, it's the father saying, well, he'll learn, leave him in jail a couple days. Some mother saying, no, you can't leave him in jail. What are you kidding? You don't know what's going to happen to him down there. You know, it's the mother seems wired hyperly compared to the man, to take care and raise kids, starting at infants, but it seems to sort of, maybe it tapers off a bit, but early on, it's the guy who, you know, just says, well, park it there, leave it. It's a woman saying, no, it's a baby, you can't do that. And so I think women probably, and others have said this, I'm not a psychiatrist, but smart people have said that could be one of the reasons why women struggle more with anxiety and depression. They're so connected to their kids that the anxiety and depression comes from the life of the kid. There's just differences in wiring. There's differences in struggle. There's differences in likes. Men tend to go into engineering far more than women, because men tend to be thing driven. Women tend to be far more relational driven. So they're the occupations that are relational: nursing, teaching, mental health, a lot of counseling. A lot of those things tend to be dominated by women. In fact, in America, there are more doctors that are female than men that are female. And as a man, I think we ought to do something about that. It ought to be 50-50. But no, there are more female doctors. No, I'm just being facetious. I got a problem today. But women tend to go more into the professions that are more interpersonal. Men tend to go into the things that are more hands driven, more Lego driven, so to speak. Of course, there are differences in sex. Women can have babies, men can't have babies, as far as I know. Things have changed. As far as I know, that's the way it works. So there are differences in male and female. And I think one error that we're seeing in our culture is to say, well, there aren't any differences. No, they're different. They are distinctly different. They are created different. Male and female, they were created. Throughout the Bible, and I could really drive this home, God deals with them differently. God will say, you know, you got to care for the widows and orphans. He doesn't necessarily say that about the men, but the widows and orphans, you got to take care of. They need your protection. They need your care. We could really, really funnel through the scriptures and see the differences. So one error is to say, again, there's no difference in male and female. The second error is, I think, which has been in the church here and there, is to say, sure, there are differences in male and female, therefore, their roles should be completely different. So women stay home. Women ought to do the cooking and the dishes and the diapers. And men ought to work and mow the grass and watch TV. So you got differences there. My dad used to have something that he had hanging in his barn, and it might have started in the house and ended up in the barn, but it was this picture. I always remember growing up. It shows the man sitting in the chair, and he's really dressed very well. He's very clean, and the woman is standing behind him with a mop, and her hair's all messed up, and her clothes are dirty. And it says the duties of a wife, and it's like 50 things. And then the duty of the man is singular. It's provide the wherewithal. So I just got to provide the wherewithal, and she's got to do everything else. And that's an old way of thinking about it. The Bible says men and women are different, but it doesn't necessarily say, therefore, men do these jobs in the house, women do these jobs. It doesn't necessarily do that. And you see that in Proverbs chapter 30. Did I give that? I don't think I gave that. Did I give that to you? 31, yeah. It says, who can find a virtuous woman? Her worth is far above rubies. The heart of her husband safely trusts her, so that we can have no lack of gain. She does him good, not evil, all the days of his life. She seeks wool and flax and willingly works with her hands. She's like a merchant ship. She brings her food from afar. She also rises while it is yet night and provides food for her household and a portion for her maidservants. She considers a field and buys it, and from her profit she plants a vineyard. And she girds herself with strength and strengthens her arms. It keeps going, but you get the point. This is Kristen Shelton we're talking about here. This is Hillary Clay. This is a woman who is extremely industrious, sort of held up as the as the woman of virtue in Proverbs. So this isn't a little wifey at home that's just confined to home. The Bible doesn't say men and women are different, therefore your jobs are entirely different. It doesn't go there. In fact, one of the jobs that our society and that even the church has designated to women that the Bible really does designate the men is teaching the children. Throughout the Old Testament, men were always in charge of teaching the children. Somehow that got shifted to the women. But strictly speaking, the Bible says that's, you know, if you're going to try to draw lines and say these are men's jobs and women's, the teaching of the children biblically would be more of a man's job. It just doesn't draw the line there. Now, you have a place like 2 Timothy chapter 2, verse 5, where it says women ought to be keepers of the house. But the context of that is that the women are gossiping, they're roaming around. He talks about how women are everywhere, they're gossiping, they're stirring up strife and contention in the church. And in the context, and other translations say they need to be busy at house. I don't know that it's necessarily saying women, you need to stay in the house and only work in the house. It seems to me that he's saying, listen, you women are running all over the place, you're stirring up strife, you're stirring up contention. Why don't you go home and get busy? In other words, in the 21st century, Paul might say, listen, you women who are at home, why don't you get off Facebook? You're stirring up all kinds of, quit gossiping. Don't you have something to clean? Don't you have something? Don't you have anybody to cook for? Be busy at the house instead of running around stirring up all kinds of trouble. And I don't think he's necessarily saying the only thing you can do is work in the house. But he's simply saying, if you're home, be busy instead of gossiping and causing church division. So again, men and women are different. One error is to deny that. The other error is to say, well, yeah, they're different. So men have these jobs and women have these jobs. What the Bible does say is that because men and women are different, they ought to come together and complete each other. That's something else that's happening in the one flesh. Men and women are wired differently. Women have strengths that men don't have. And as they relate to each other, there ought to be a submission to each other and a completion of each other. I mean, listen, the longer you go in a marriage, if you're learning, and you're not always learning in a marriage, but the longer you go, the better the marriage gets, the more you realize as a husband that she has strengths you don't have, and you need to listen to her. And hopefully, and I'm speaking for myself, hopefully she's saying, he has strengths I don't have, and I ought to listen to him. And when the marriage is working right, it's sort of like, I don't know anything about music, but when I listen to jazz music, it's a beautiful thing when the guys know when to come in and do their part, and it's just sort of flowing together. People know when to step forward. People know when to step back. I mean, I don't know how they do that. I don't know if they arrange it or if they just get, I don't know. How does that work? They're just flowing. I mean, it's just like they're, you know, they're making beautiful music together and they're reading each other and they're going with it. It's almost like a dance, you know. They're just, somehow they're moving in the same way. A good marriage is like that. I mean, listen, women tend to think more broadly. Women are better multitaskers in general. Men are more linear thinkers. In a good marriage, the couple has just figured out, hey, this is a multitasking problem. Let the woman lead. I don't know how to get this house clean. I mean, that's me. I look at where do you start with this house? I'm just going to have to be told what to do. I don't know. I mean, the only way to fix this is to put it all in bags and put it in the basement, and then if you need it, take it out. I don't know how to do it. I can't multitask like she can multitask. Planning trips. You know how frustrating it is for a man to pack? How do you know? I mean, you need everything because you're gone a week, but you need only the minimum because you only got so much room. That is a multitasking job. That's where the man says, yes, dear. You just learn to do that. Linear thinking, long-term thinking, that can be more of a man's job. There are times when the wife has to say, listen, I'm not particularly as strong as you are, maybe in 5 and 10 year plans. I mean, you're thinking about retirement. You got to come up with a retirement plan. You're better at that than I am. And the wife just sort of knows a step back and say, husband, you go. And the husband just says, oh, that's a feminine skill. You go. I mean, we're completing each other in that sense. Women tend to be better, although I would debate, you know, but there are a lot of exceptions. Women tend to be better in team building. Men tend to be better in hierarchical structure. So, for instance, they've done studies, and if you put a group of men in a corn maze and a group of women in a corn maze, the women will try to make mutual decisions and form a committee. The men will elect a leader. We're just going with the king, man. Well, there are times when you need a committee. There are times when you need a leader. And in a good marriage, you just see a problem and it's like, we're going to have to talk this thing through. Who's the better talker in this family? There she is. Lead us. We're going to talk about this thing. And the man just has to say, this is a talking problem. You got to do this. There are other times when it's like, hey, this is somebody's got to point and say, we're going in that direction. The wife, you know, in the dance, it's like, this is something more of a masculine thing. I'll follow you. Sometimes the husband follows the man. My mom and dad were good double teaming us as kids because mom was a typical woman in that she could sit and listen and absorb feelings. And so when people's hearts were broken, you wanted mom, right? If the boy dumped my sister, they always wanted to talk to mom. Mom was tea and sympathy, man. And they could get that. But there were times when it's like, no, dad knows how to put the fear of God in people. And there are times when kids need to be loved and understood. And there are times when the sheriff has to come out. Say, as for me and my house, here's the line. Not going to get crossed. And they were great at sort of the dance and say, this is a dad problem. This is a mom problem. This is more of a masculine problem. This is more of a feminine problem. A marriage is completion. I don't have everything I need to live life well. A woman doesn't have everything she needs to live life well. Now, I should say this. God can fill in gaps. God can fill in gaps. If you're single, you don't say necessarily, I'm incomplete, because God can fill in gaps. But when a marriage comes together, when husband and wife comes together, the goal is completion. I recognize the differences. She recognizes the differences. And as we face life together, we're able to say, listen, we have a great skill set. We're both assertive and filling. We can do committee or we can do leadership. We can do long-term thinking. We can do short-term thinking. Between the two of us, we're really good at loving on our kids and counseling and crying with them, and we're really, really good at scaring the snot out of them. If the two of us can get together, we are a dynamic duo. We just got to figure out who needs to step back and let the other one go and follow, and who else needs to step back and then maybe the other one follow. Now, we read this passage, and I'm just about finished, by the way. We read this passage where it says, wives submit because the husband is the head of the wife. You say, well, what does that mean? I think that's one of the most practical passages in Scripture. And I think sometimes it's misunderstood. It doesn't mean that there isn't mutual submission, I think, because it's already said, submit to one another. It doesn't mean that there isn't conversation, that there aren't mutual decisions. I think what it means is that inevitably when you hit roadblocks in your marriage, you got to figure out how you're going to handle the roadblocks before it comes up. You're naive if you think every decision can be talked through. They can't. Every decision can't be resolved. You ought to try to resolve every decision through conversation. You ought to try to figure out who has better expertise, who has a better feel for this, and one needs to follow the other. But inevitably, you do reach some places in your marriage where you can't talk your way to a conclusion. I mean, listen, August 1st. School starts August 6th. I'm adamant that they need to go to a Christian school. She's adamant they need to go to a public school. And we got to make a decision now. And we're both adamant. Somebody's got to have to make a decision. She's received a job offer, pays her twice as much. They've always lived in Greene County. His whole family is in Greene County. He's adamant this is the place to raise kids. And that's what's important. She's adamant this is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity and we need to move to Knoxville. And you can talk that blue until you're blue in the faces. Sometimes you just hit a roadblock. You can't go forward. There are those kinds of things. She wants three kids. He's adamant he don't want none. That's it. Yeah. You're naive to think you can talk everything through to a conclusion. If you don't have a pre-designed way to handle those roadblocks, how does the decision get made? Well, it all depends who's best at manipulation. The person who can threaten the most, who can cry the hardest, who can convince the other one if they don't do it their way, they're leaving. Whoever can sell the biggest lie or make the biggest threat or manipulate the best is going to win that argument if you don't know how you're going to settle it before you get there. And your marriage can only take so many of those fights until the cracks become permanent. You can only take so many roadblocks where there's crying and screaming, and if you don't do this, I'm out of here. And I mean, it can only take so many head-on nuclear collisions until it can't function anymore. And so you have to have a plan for those places you get at in life where we can't talk our way out of it. I'm 100% here and I can't be convinced, and you're 100% and you can't be convinced. I think what the Bible is saying is for a Christian family, if you get there, the husband ought to make the decision. That ought to be the pre-agreed upon way of handling that. I think that's what the headship means. It doesn't mean that you shouldn't talk as long as you can and try to work this out. It doesn't mean there's not mutual submission. The first step is not for the husband to say, well, this is what I want. That's not the first step. The first step is to talk, to work it out, to exhaust every means available to reach a conclusion, an agreeable conclusion. You know, that's a decision. And Paul will say in Corinthians, I think to the best of a woman's ability, to submit. And as she submits, who knows, he says, whether her husband might be converted through her respect and submission to him. Now, again, the question is, well, what if he is asking or demanding things that are ungodly, that she looks at that and he says, for instance, hey, you know what? We need to put our money together because, you know, I'm betting $5,000 in Vegas, whether you like, you know, it's an ungodly thing. I think you can make the case, and a lot of theologians would, that a husband's authority is predicated on him being under the authority of God. So in other words, let's say God's the general So let's say you have an army. You have a general, a captain, and a lieutenant. Does the captain have to obey the, does a lieutenant have to obey the captain if the captain is not under the authority of the general? Or should you obey the general? Should you obey the person right over you, or should you obey the top person? And if the person over you gets out of authority, should you obey the person above them? And I tend to believe that, taken as a whole, if a, I think the two things there, I think if a husband, although he's not a believer, loves his wife and cares for her and is a moral person, she ought to do everything she can to respect him and be obedient. In those crises, now again, you may only have five or six of those places in your life. You may be able to resolve the issues by talking 99.9% of the time. Ideally, you could get there 100% of the time. It's just realistically, you probably can't. So, but I think if the husband loves his wife and is working and is moral, although maybe not righteous, that she should do everything that she can. If he's clearly ungodly, if he clearly, as a captain, has declared war on the general, I think she ought to follow the general, which is God, in that situation. And I don't think anybody, no one in the world is under the command of Scripture to obey someone who has their, who does not have their good in mind. You know, in fact, in the Old Testament, and I got to let you go here, you remember when God comes to Samuel and says, "Now, I've rejected Saul. I want you to go to Bethlehem and anoint David as king." And Samuel says to Saul, "Well," or Samuel says to God, "Yeah, but Saul's going to find out I'm in Bethlehem, and he's going to wonder what I'm up to because he's insecure. If Saul asks me what I'm doing in Bethlehem, what should I tell him?" And God says to Samuel, "If Saul asks you that, tell him you've just gone to Bethlehem to sacrifice offerings to have a church service with Jesse and his boys." And so essentially what God is saying is listen to him. Saul's out of my will. Saul has evil intentions for David and for you. You're under no authority for me to be obedient to Saul and even tell him the truth in that situation. Now, that's Samuel with a direct word from God. So God's not telling you to lie. But God was saying, I think, in that, I think there's a principle there, which is if Samuel has evil in mind, don't submit to him. Don't tell him what he wants to know. And again, we all know, you know, the disciples would say, it's better to obey God than man. So no one is under any obligation from God if the person giving the order has ill will towards you, or they're asking you to sin. But if they love you, if they honestly want your good, if they care about you, if they're not asking you to sin, even if they're a non-believer, I think you ought to be submissive to them. Again, if you get into that place where there's just no way forward. The point is, and this is it, and I'm finished. This is a beautiful thing of coming together. Let me show you something that you may not have seen, and then I'm finished. In Genesis chapter 1, don't turn there. You can if you want. I'm not telling you what to do. The whole creation narrative is about opposites coming together to make something wonderful. So God starts out and says night and day. And night and day comes together, and it's beautiful. Isn't it beautiful at sunset when day is giving way to night? And then the sky and the earth. They're different. The sky's not the earth. The earth's not the sky. But isn't it beautiful how they come together? And then on earth, you have dry land and waters. Don't you love to stand on the seashore? The waters meet the dry land. Water isn't dry land. Dry land isn't water. But together, don't they make the world a beautiful place? And then, you know, the two great lights, the sun and the moon. They're wonderful. And then later on, you have the living creatures. And you have men and women. And men and women aren't the living creatures. The living creatures aren't men. But isn't it wonderful when you can eat a fish? How it just comes. No. But it's... Isn't the animal world and the human world, isn't it nice when they get along, you know, you're sitting there, the interaction, the dogs, not the cats, but the dogs, and the interaction's beautiful. And so here you have things that aren't alike, but they come together to make something immeasurably beautiful. And then he gets all the way down and he says, and male and female. So male and female come together like the sea, like the land, like the earth, like the sky, like the sun, like the moon, like day and night. There are opposites, but when they come together, they create something beautiful. When they come together and they complete, they sort of complete each other, they give way to each other. It's just a beautiful, beautiful thing. All right, God bless you tonight. Hey, next Sunday.